And now I would like to introduce our speaker for this evening, Kevin from Santa Maria.
I was hoping to do birthdays first. Hi, I'm Kevin. I'm an alcoholic. I was told 45 minutes, and so I think the best plan for me is if we all, if you join with me for a good 45-minute moment of silence while we, for those in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I know I don't get off that easy. Thank you very much for having me. I really am honored and nervous. Clayton, I'm with you, bud. I'm glad you're here, too. That's awesome. My sobriety date is January 25th, 2017, so I still got training wheels on this bike. We'll get into the solution at the end, but I honestly thought there was no solution for me. And the fact that I'm here after 2.5 years is a miracle. And it's thanks to rooms like these all over the place that are open for me wherever I'm at and do offer me a solution to when I thought there was none. Because that's a pretty desperate place to be when you think there's not a solution. So let's go from the start and we'll go into the fun stuff. I was born in New Jersey, but I didn't stay there long. My father wanted to see what it was like. He was a stockbroker. And he wanted to see what it was like to work on Wall Street. And so we were there briefly enough to have me. But I've been told that being born in New Jersey is enough of a reason to be an alcoholic. And so I'm not going to blame that. There's a lot of other things that went on. But they left New Jersey right away. I was born to a blonde-haired, blue-eyed mother, sorority girl, and a Division I basketball player father. Had everything that life could offer. I had no needs. I have no reason to be an alcoholic. I got no desperation. I got no bad family stories. There is alcoholism in my family, but I've got nothing to blame it on from my upbringing. They were wonderful parents. But I had this feeling at a very young age that I was handed a checklist on the happiness, the secrets to the happiness of life. And the checklist had all the obvious stuff on it. Go to school, get good grades, go to college, get a wife, buy a house, have 3 kids. All those things were on my checklist. And I don't know if it was given to me by my parents. I don't know if society gave it to me. The further I get into sobriety, I understand that probably none of them did. It was all in my head. But that's what I felt was going to bring me happiness in life. And so I immediately started just checking them off. In elementary school, I was that kid that was supposed to be to my parents. I was a little blonde-haired, blue-eyed, cute kid, and I got great grades. I was very popular, and things were rolling right along. Then in sixth grade, the most popular girl in school asked me to be her boyfriend. I didn't have any idea what that meant. I had no idea. I was the most immature little kid. I was just rolling through life, and I had nothing to poke me in the butt to force me to be immature. I had all my needs taken, so I didn't know what was going on, but it was on my checklist, so I said, I'll be your boyfriend. And this young gal was ready to go, and I was like, what in the heck is going on? I'm in sixth grade. I might as well be in second grade. I look like I'm 2. And it was absolutely miserable. The weight of the world fell on my shoulders. I can remember it. I can know the feeling to this day. I'm out of my league in so many ways, not just because she's the most popular girl in school. So many ways I'm out of my league. I'm out of my comfort zone in every single way. I'm not ready for this stuff. The best day of elementary school was when she broke up with me. That was awesome. Everything fell off, and I could go back to being what I wanted to be at the time, which was extremely immature. And the worst thing about elementary school is that it led into junior high. I didn't think it had to do that. Kind of wanted to hang out there, but it had to. And so junior high, the wheels kind of fell off. I got into junior high, and my friends were ready to do things that I wasn't ready to do, the same as this gal. They were doing stuff that I wasn't ready to do. I was, I just, I had, I wasn't ready for the for that part of the world. I really enjoyed life. I was doing well, and I wasn't ready for the things that junior high offered, the choices that junior high brought me. And I started, that was the first time I realized that isolating was one of my coping mechanisms, is that if I wasn't, peer pressure really didn't work on me, which is a blessing, and that's, I equate that to that drugs are not part of my story, drugs were never part of my story, and it's because peer pressure didn't work on me. I was fiercely afraid of drugs, and all my friends were doing them, and that was the 80s, and so, you know, cocaine was everywhere, and marijuana, of course, was everywhere, and I was so scared of those things. I don't know if it was a, I think it's a real blessing, because I think if I would have tried cocaine, I would have absolutely loved it, because it would have given me a chance to drink more, from what I'm told. But peer pressure didn't work on me. But what I would do when I'd felt that peer pressure is I would have to escape from those people, and I would just go isolate. And I started missing class to go, actually, I would miss class. Most people would cut class, and they would go off and party and do their thing. I would cut class, and my neighbor across the street, they both worked, so that I'd know there'd be no one home. So I'd go hide in their backyard. And I would sit there until I knew that the bell had rung for school, and I was free to go outside and not get caught cutting class. And that was really the first time I started kind of isolating from everyone. And my grades dropped dramatically. And in my household, it was really, really how you looked, not who you were. We really wanted to look good to the rest of society. And so my mother's solution to my grades falling and to things starting to go off the tracks was to do everything for me. Mm-hmm. So she did my homework for me. Mm-hmm. She made sure I made things. She pretty much dressed me. Just I was really following that checklist and really conforming to what everybody else wanted, even though it was terribly uncomfortable. And at that point, I had not discovered alcohol yet, but I had discovered isolation. And so I would hide. Junior high led to high school. I was barely scraping by. You know, here I went in elementary school, just straight A's and everything like this, and I'm getting C's, you know, doing everything I could to keep them from D's. And there was... there was really no question on what's going on with Kevin. I didn't even know what was going on with Kevin. It was more, let's just make Kevin look all right. Let's do the things we need to do to make up for what he's not doing and see if we can get him through this thing. And high school, the main thing that scared me about high school, you can see that I'm not tall, dark, and handsome. And in high school, I was so underdeveloped and so emotionally immature because I wasn't facing the things that I needed to face that I was so scared. The one thing that scared me in high school the most was I knew we had to shower together after PE. And here's all these big dudes walking around just fully developed. I'm like, oh my God, I'm gonna have to shower with these guys. I don't even have any grass on the infield. I am going to be set up for ridicule so bad. And it was, you know how we get in our heads. It was constantly in my head. They're going to make me shower with these guys, and they're going to see that I've got a 12-year-old body. I always said that my higher power thought it was absolutely hysterical to stick a grown man in the body of a 12-year-old girl, because that's the way I've had to live my whole life. And so I was extremely scared of so many things in high school like that. And eventually, I was maturing a bit, and I was catching up to my friends, and I got invited to a party. And that's where I had my first taste of alcohol. And I remember I remember being curious of what it was going to do, why it was, because alcohol was always a part of my family. It was a big part of my family. My dad was a very high-functioning alcoholic. My mom was not an alcoholic. My mom's definitely a normie. But alcohol was an everyday occurrence. That was their whole social life. And so I was really curious on why alcohol was such a big deal. And I remember taking that first drink, and I remember kind of feeling it just kind of go. And I remember that party like it was yesterday. And it didn't, I hear so many people in these rooms say it finally made them feel normal and they were able to come out of their skin. It didn't really do that to me. It just made me feel comfortable in that room but I didn't jump out and say, I want to do this every day. But it did make me feel so much better. But if I look back, I'm trying to look back since I'm so young in sobriety. If there was any trigger there, and I didn't think at the time there was. I was just trying to do what made everyone happy, and so I didn't really fall into alcohol completely, although I started, that is exactly when I started drinking. It must have been about 16 or 17. I got through high school by the skin of my teeth, and I had no direction. I was still incredibly emotionally, I was not of my age. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I would just look at my mom and say, what do you want me to do? What's next on the checklist? Well, it was college. I did not want to go to college. I wanted nothing to do with school at that point. I was a good worker, and that has saved me throughout my life. I love to work. I love to get a paycheck. I absolutely love that paycheck. And that's one thing I've had to learn in these rooms is that I need to be able to help people. And I need to get out of my comfort zone, pick up trash, do whatever I need to do without expecting a paycheck, without you guys saying, oh, look at Kevin, he picked up that trash. He's a wonderful human being. Good job, Kevin. I really had to get over that hurdle. But I just wanted to go to work, and I wanted to be done with school. But because I am not a very strong individual, obviously, and I don't have the ability to pave my own way, I went to college, and it was junior college. And again, there I am at junior college, hating school, but doing what I need to do because it's on the checklist. And I'm getting C's and getting barely by. And I, at that point, finally knew that something had to happen. Something had to tweak Kevin, or it was going to be pretty pathetic. And so I went to my parents. I had this idea, and I said, I was scared to death to do it because I thought the answer would be no. But I said, would you send me for a semester to Europe? And their answer real quick was yes, because they knew it too. Something had to change direction. And it was completely out of my comfort zone. I don't know how I got the idea. I think hopefully it was my higher power saying something's got to get this kid out of this rut, because he's got a little more to offer this world than just this. And so off I went to London. The beauty was that I knew no one. I was absolutely 100% completely out of my comfort zone. My comfort zone is a very toxic, a very idle, a very miserable place to be. If I look back at anything that has been wonderful in my life, it's because I was pushed out of my comfort zone to get into it. And so this was the first time that I was really pushed out of my comfort zone. I land in London, and I don't know anyone there. I don't have anyone doing anything for me. I got to do my laundry. I got to get myself up. I got to get to class. I got to do everything myself. And it was awesome. It did exactly what I had hoped it would do. It got me motivated. I became my own person. I got away from the people that were, it wasn't their fault they were controlling me. I was allowing it. I didn't have the guts to, so I'm not blaming them at all. It couldn't, they wanted the best for me. They did it completely out of love. Everyone that directed me was doing it out of complete love. But I didn't have the guts to say, no, this is not me. I'm going to forge my own life. So this was the first time I was away from all that. And I really got to grow into Kevin. And I really got interested in girls. Trying to attract girls, trying to find out who I was, and I found out real quick that women really are into tall, dark, and handsome. Terrible realization. And I tried, but it wasn't working out for me. But I found out another thing is that the gay crowd's completely the opposite. They were attracted, and. And so there I was, and I was so excited. I was accepted by someone. I said, man, this is awesome. I'm finally finding my crowd. The problem is that you can't just make yourself gay to be accepted by the crowd. I couldn't go with that little thing that really qualified me for the group. They were wonderful people, and man, I wanted to be accepted by someone, but I couldn't go with that final initiation thing. So I found myself back with the group that didn't want me, or wasn't interested. It wasn't they didn't want me. They weren't as that interested. But I was really found that I was really fond of alcohol at that time because I was legally able to drink in London at the time. I was 18, and we really did it up. We went all over Europe with very little money. That was part of the exciting part. Everything was uncomfortable. I was exposed to things that I needed to be exposed to. I got a lot more worldly, a lot more self-confidence. Finally, the self-confidence was brewing, but alcohol was definitely was becoming an everyday thing. And no one really saw it as a problem as of yet, but London was about to end, and it ended, and I came back, and the whole world had changed for me. It was a lot different, and I remember landing back in the United States, and everything seemed different. The traffic lights, the roads, the house I lived in, everything just seemed different in a positive way. But as soon as I got back, boom, fell right back in to where Kevin was, right back to the checklist, right back to the comfort zone. And what do you do when you're in that zone and you're done with junior college? Your mom picks your college. And that's what brought me here. She picked Cal Poly for me. Found a major that was not impacted that would take a C student at a junior college. And I got right into Cal Poly. Cal Poly was, it was a great place to be. The first thing I did was join a fraternity. And I went to the fraternity rushes, and I found the one that was most like Animal House, because I could fit into that. And we were a bunch of very different people that were really bonded by the use of alcohol. And I started drinking very heavily, just getting by school. I was so used to that. I didn't have the self-confidence to think that I had anything more to offer than a C. I even had a teacher chase me down in a hallway and saying, "What's wrong with you? You're smart enough. Why the lack of effort? Why the lack of initiative?" That really touched me, that a teacher would take the time to do that, that he saw something in me that I couldn't see in myself. Was it enough to propel me to any better? No, I didn't have the self-confidence. I was willing just to skate and let alcohol start to fill that hole that was inside of me that that kept me from seeking better for myself. And I started drinking a lot. But because we were so bonded in that fraternity by alcohol, problems were coming for us. And the administration of Cal Poly was watching us because we were getting into trouble as a group. And that was being a fraternity at that time that was acting as we were was extremely unpopular with the authorities, with the press. You guys all knew in the late 80s, things were coming down on fraternities that acted like this. It was not acceptable behavior anymore. We came to a night, our Christmas party was, I became president of that fraternity. And during my presidency, the Christmas party, the theme of the Christmas party was that the president got to take the night off from his responsibilities as president, and he would be Santa Claus. And the vice president would take over the duties of all the responsibility. And the president, all the gifts that night, every gift that was alcohol, the president, the Santa Claus, would have to take a shot of that alcohol. He got to choose two little sisters, and you chose them for their depth of alcohol use because you could pass one off to them if you were getting too much. But you can imagine how that ended up, because in a fraternity that's based on alcohol, every present is alcohol. So I'm in a bad state of mind, but not as bad as another member in that fraternity. He came to the party extremely inebriated from a dinner they had before the party, and then thought it would be a great idea to take a big gulp cup, a 32-ounce big gulp cup, fill it with Wild Turkey 101, and show everyone that he could drink it in one gulp. He was already very inebriated. And he did that and immediately passed out in everyone's arms. And thank the Lord that these people that he passed out in their arms had the wherewithal to throw him in the back of a truck and get him to a hospital, because he was in bad shape. He holds the San Luis Obispo County record for alcohol level. Mm-hmm. Anyone want to guess what that is?
2.
It's bad. What was that?
2.4.
He wishes it was that.
5.7.
Double that and then go a little higher.
Wow.
It's 0.62. I know, it doesn't sound, I think Oprah had a show on it where they said that the highest they got on that show was 0.45 or something like that, and that's really bad. We were told that he would either, he would be one of two things. He's going to die, or he's going to be, he's not going to have any brain function anymore. It's one of those two things. But this kid, other than being an absolute idiot, had a metabolism that none of us could ever believe. He was just a long, skinny rail, and they pumped his stomach. They got him there so fast, pumped his stomach, that he is fine to this day. Thank goodness. But the whole world came down on the president of that fraternity because it was all over the news. I was on the front page of the San Luis Obispo Tribune as the president. I had to symbolically step down, and someone who was gaining self-confidence, everything crashed down on me. I had constant flow of policemen, reporters coming to my room wanting interviews. I had to go down and talk to the police. Someone in that has my maturity at the time and stuff like that doesn't know how to deal with something like this. And so I had a futon that I slept on, and that thing would crunch up. And then when you crunched it up, it looked like a taco. I don't know if you remember those type of futons that would do that. I spent about a month sleeping in that taco, completely drunk, hiding from anyone that came in my room. I could hear them come in my room, and they'd look around, and then they'd leave. Hard to get good grades when you're doing that. Somehow I was able to still get my C's and get through Cal Poly, but that was the first time I absolutely grasped onto alcohol to get me through life. Because I, instead of just face what I had to face, instead of face it like a man and get through it, I couldn't do it. I hid from it. I did what I had to do to stay at Cal Poly. I did what I had to do to stay out of jail, because there was threats of that. Even though the kid was 21 and he was not a pledge, we still had some stuff going down. I remember calling my dad because it's such a different generational thing, and alcohol was so accepted in our family. And I called my dad and I said, "Dad, the world is coming down on me. This is what happened." He's like, "I don't understand the big deal." I'm like, I'm all, "Dad, this is not the 60s anymore. You know, this is, you don't put the dead pledge on the porch and have someone pick him up in the morning. This is a real big deal." And he could never understand, my family couldn't understand what the big deal was and what was going on. And he should have probably been scared of getting sued at that point. But that all ended. I finished Cal Poly, and I went back to where I was raised in San Jose. To look for a job. While I failed to mention, I had bartended on weekends through college because that was a great job for someone who liked alcohol. So I went back to San Jose to find a job in my major, half-heartedly, and I had a bartending job back there. And so I half-heartedly looked for a real job because making money as a bartender, it's pretty good money and you can drink. And I was full-blown alcoholic at that time. That's the one time in my life, a pretty long stretch, where I drank every single night. I did the same thing that a lot of us talk about, swearing it off every day, saying, "I'm not going to do it tonight. I'm going to take a night off." I could never take a night off. I distinctly remember an absolute fear of the dentist. Whenever they would say you'd have a dental appointment, I could just imagine opening my mouth with the smells that would come out of that mouth, and the horrible, the day after drinking alcohol, that the systemic alcohol, I hate the systemic smell of it coming out of your pores, of coming out of my mouth. And I said, if I have a dental appointment, I am not going to drink tonight. There's no way I'm going to sit in that dental chair and open my mouth and have them work on a mouth that's going to smell like that. And then sitting in that dental chair and going, "Holy crap, I drank. I said I wasn't going to. Now I have to face these people's faces. They're going to be mortified at what they have to deal with on this patient." But I couldn't stop drinking. I just couldn't do it, no matter how much I wanted to and how bad I felt inside. I couldn't do it. So I had, I just kind of existed in San Jose. I had a fiance at the time who did become my wife, but, and she was working very hard. And I got a call from a friend I went to Cal Poly with, And he said, I'm opening up a restaurant nightclub in San Luis Obispo, and you've bartended for so long, and I know you so well. I would love it if you came and helped me open it. Well, hallelujah. I'm going to get to come back to the Central Coast, and I'm going to have a job I can drink at. Whoa. Everything's opening up for me. And that was Mother's Tavern. And so I asked my wife to be, if she'd like to go back to San Luis. It was a pretty easy sell because home prices in San Jose, I said, if we ever want a home, we need to get to the Central Coast. I did a pretty good sales pitch. What I wanted to do was drink and work. So she agreed because she was miserable with her job, and we came back to San Luis Obispo, and I worked the first 8 years at Mother's Tavern. Worked very hard. We would work from, they had me working from 11 in the morning till 3:30 in the morning, 6 days a week. I was a manager, so usually on the seventh day, you got called back in. I was drinking every night. I felt absolutely so horrible inside, so toxic and just physically miserable inside that I remember no one had ever told me that alcoholics could internally bleed, but I had this innate thing that every time I went to the bathroom that it was going to be blood. It was just a fear. I feel so bad. It has to manifest somehow, doesn't it? Something has to give inside my body because it's so horrible. And I remember it never did, but I remember looking over it. And I remember looking in the mirror after doing that in the bathroom at like 3 a.m. and I would see my face and I go, man, you don't look like an alcoholic. Thank God you don't look like one. And I would be okay with that because I was still young and I was, but not looking like, again, appearances are more important. Like I can go on society. I don't look like an alcoholic, but it's okay. It's okay to know you are. And it's okay to be self-loathing and have all this toxicity inside yourself, but you don't look like it. So keep on going. That's the next step on the checklist was having 3 kids. And I started that when I was at Mother's Tavern. I had my daughter, and one of the benefits was that I came from a line of people who were alcoholic in my family were functioning, and I could function halfway decent. I could still bring home a paycheck. I was a decent dad, but you can only be so decent when you're drinking that much. There's a certain amount of vacancy that's going to be in that head. But I did get to walk my daughter every morning and sing songs, and having a daughter was fabulous. But it was nowhere near enough to get me to stop drinking. There was nothing that was going to get me to stop drinking. So very quickly after my daughter, we had my son. They're only, I think, they're roughly 2 years apart. We have him, and I'm still full-blown drinking every night. And I know in my head and I know in my heart I want to stop, that it has to give, but there is no way I can stop. There is no way I can stop. And I finally get a DUI. As many times as I drove home drunk from that place, I cannot imagine I didn't get more, but I finally got a DUI. And I'm coming out of that jail in San Luis Obispo to a Ford minivan with a scared as heck wife looking at me. She knew it was coming. She wasn't that scared. She knew it was coming. I mean, she had to sleep with me. You talk about the dentist smelling me. My Lord, what that woman had to go through and the amount of times that she had to beg me to stop or try and find a solution that she was powerless over. And for some reason, she stuck with me. But to come out of that jail to a minivan with 2 beautiful kids in their little car seats, I'll never forget the picture. The door slides open, and there's 2 kids happy as heck to see their dad, not knowing where they are. They're just happy to see me, you know? And there's my wife just going, whoa, the look of pity on her face, and it wasn't even anger anymore. She was beyond the anger. And to sit down in that minivan, I'll never forget that. But was it enough to get me to stop? I stopped for a bit. That's the first time I white-knuckled it. And I did all right. I white-knuckled it for, when I first came in the rooms, I said 10 years. But as you get sober, reality kind of sets in and you kind of correct the numbers that you do. I don't know if I can really correct the numbers I did, but I white-knuckled it for a long time. I would say maybe 4 or 5 years. But in the back of my head, I knew it was never forever. I knew that, I knew I had to stop forever, but I knew I couldn't stop forever. There was no solution for me. There was none. I had always wanted, the amount of times that I had wanted to stop and I just couldn't, I had just completely sold myself out that this was life for me. And so I white-knuckled it for all those times, but what are us alcoholics going to do eventually is we're going to find a way. We're going to darn well find a way. And it, the first crack was that my son was very, very good at soccer. And that's why I say, I know I white-knuckled it for about 4, maybe 5 or 6 years, is that he got good at soccer. He started very young when he was 4, and by about 5 or 6, he was already on a traveling team. And I was in heaven. I absolutely love the sport of soccer. I love that sport. It's the only sport that I was good at. And when my son was good at it, I was in seventh heaven, especially when we got to start traveling. And so we traveled for a few months until the light hit me. Man, when I'm traveling with him, I'm not around anyone. He's too young to know I'm drinking. My wife's not around. My family's not around. I can drink on these traveling soccer. I can go to the games in the day, drink all night. And it won't be a problem when I get back. I'll just white knuckle it again and I'll just do it on these soccer trips. So I start doing that. And at the time I have I'm done with Mother's Tavern, because the DUI was when I was done with Mother's Tavern, and I got into IT. And I got a corporate IT job that asked me to start traveling. Oh my goodness, that's more nights I'm not around anyone. Holy God, the whole world's opening up for me again. But I'm not going to do it like I did do it. I'm just going to do it on these nights, right? I'm just going to do it when I'm gone on these nights, and I'll be able to handle it, because everything's great in my life again, and I really wasn't an alcoholic. That was just a phase. I was just in my 20s and 30s. Early 30s, and it was just a phase, and I'm over it, you know, and everything's going to be good. Well, that's not enough. You know, those business trips and those soccer things eventually aren't enough, so I start faking business trips. I have a little office in Orchid, so I fake business trips, and I drink there, and I'm never going to get caught. Plus, it's not a problem yet. I'm just doing it when I want to do it, and I deserve it, right? Because I'm raising a family. I'm bringing home a paycheck. I'm checking things off of my checklist. I deserve this, and I'm gonna do it. And you know, it's my wife's too smart. She smells it on me. She knows that stuff, but she's just crossing her fingers that it's really not happening again. And of course, I'm never going to tell the truth. I'm a lying piece of crud. I'm going to do everything I can to keep the gig going, not give it up. And so I am going to do everything I can so that you guys don't know I'm drinking. No one knows I'm drinking, but I can do it. It starts progressing, and I start getting those same feelings. It progresses very fast at that point. And I start getting those feelings again, like, yep, this is life. This is it for me. Maybe I can white-knuckle it again at some point, but I'll never, ever be able to stop until the day I die. This is going to be my life. I'm going to wish for better. I'm going to pray for better, but it's never going to come for me. So just live with it. Figure out ways to keep the alcohol coming, and figure out ways to still keep the paychecks coming and all that stuff, and do the best you can and look as good as you can to the outside world and ignore what's going on inside. Well, there's a night I'm drinking in my office and I get a text from my wife. Where are you really? I go, oh, that's not a text I wanted. And I said, my God, the gig is up. I better get darn quick to where I'm supposed to be, or it's over. The problem is that where I'm supposed to be is in the Mojave Desert at a cement plant where my job was. And so, but my solution is I better jump in that car and get there. Well, between here and the Mojave Desert is 166, so you could pick a lot better roads to drive drunk than that road. I've driven that road so many times since, and I try to find a place on that road. You drive that road one time and try to find a place to go off the road that's safe. Yeah. It's not many. There is not many. But I got all the way almost to the five, and I want to say I fell asleep, but obviously I passed out, and I ended up in front of a semi truck, and he blasted me into a agriculture field. I don't know where that agriculture field is. I can go back. I drive there more. Where's that agriculture field that I end up in? I don't know. I don't know where the heck it's at, but I ended up in the middle of an agriculture field, and all I remember is kind of going on the door to try and get it open. I don't know. I at this point, I had no idea what had happened. I had no idea, but I got that door open and I got out of the car. And I looked back at the car, and I didn't think once, did I just hit a station wagon filled with wonderful people and kill them all? I didn't think that once. I didn't think, oh my God, what really just happened here? I looked back and I thought, the gig is up. I was so calm, and I was like, thank God, I'm finally exposed for the lying piece of crud that I am, and I don't have to lie anymore. I got two things that are gonna happen. Everyone in this world's gonna leave me, and I'll finally get to do this alcoholism thing the way that I wanna do it. I'm gonna have no hold bars. I can just go down and just do it right, or everyone's gonna stick with me, and I have to find a solution. I have to. There's no in between anymore. There's nothing in between anymore. So I found out that I didn't kill anyone, and that it was a semi truck, and that doesn't lighten it. It still sticks in my head that poor guy driving that semi truck. I hope he's okay in the head, because he nailed someone bad and sent him off into a thing. And that doesn't leave me for a moment on what I did to that poor man. And I pray that he mentally is okay with it, and realizes that he just hit a total jerk who affected his life negatively and got past it. So I face it and go and find out what's going to happen. Is everyone going to leave me, or is people going to stick with me and find a solution? Well, they stick with me again. And the first thing of order is that I tell my wife that she has to go with me to an AA meeting, because that first DUI, I had a court card, and I found out how horrible this place is, and I really did hate it. I really did hate it, and it's an easy thing to equate it to, but it's exactly what I equated it to, is it was a Star Wars bar. Everyone was weird and ugly and all this weird stuff going on, and there's people with cigarettes here and a coffee cup here, and they're like, to me, everyone was just hanging on. I'm going to be sober today. I'm going to be sober today. I'm like, I don't want that. There's nothing here for me. I can maybe remember tidbits of a couple meetings I had to go to. I had to go to quite a few. But other than that, I was completely shut off to these rooms, completely. When people say that they have blinders on these rooms, I can relate, because I did. I sat in the corner. I didn't hear a thing anyone said. I wasn't looking for any solution. I wasn't looking for anything in here. I was looking to get my court card signed. I was not smart enough to just sign it on my own. I hope no one's in here for that. I don't want to give anyone ideas. But I went to them. I didn't get anything from it. I got out of them. I was so unready to find any solution. And as much as I wanted a solution, it was not here. So on this time, I said, you're going to come with me to a meeting, and you're going to go with me, because I don't want to get nagged about AA as a solution. You're going to come with me. You're going to see how bad it is. You're going to see how rotten it is. You're going to see the people that I would have to hang out with to get sober. And you're gonna say, oh, you're right, and we'll go off and find a solution somewhere else. And it was a Friday night podium meeting at the 1600 Club in Santa Maria. And there's a few of you wonderful people that were there that night. And I got in there, and you jerks wouldn't let me leave. I got swarmed. You wouldn't let me leave until I understood that there was solution, that there was hope in these rooms. And, oh, shit. For someone who doesn't think there is any hope, that there's no solution, I could never. It touches me, because I really thought there was no solution. I really thought that there was nothing that was going to keep me from being an alcoholic. You guys threw a big book in my hand. You gave me a meeting list. about 10 guys signed the front of that book cover and made darn sure that I was well taken care of and I would be back the next night, and I haven't stopped since. I started hearing things that I had never heard in my life. Let me rephrase that. I had probably heard them a million times, and they went right past. I started listening to what was being said by people and started hearing how you guys got sober, how things worked in your life. I spent the first 3 months, I didn't say a word. I didn't sit on the outside. I sat right in with you guys. I didn't say a word. No one asked me to share. I was too scared to anyway. I just sat and I listened, and I got very, very book smart. I understood everything that I started to understand what things that were being said, but I was not social enough. I was so scared still that I could not become a part of the herd. I was still on the outside. I wasn't equating things in my life. I was just getting book smart. About the fourth month, let me say this, because this is important for any newcomers, I think, who are struggling with that. Because I'm an alcoholic, I'm smart. I know what I need to get. I figured out that if I wash the coffee cups, you guys will come talk to me. And that's how I can meet people. It's a little trick I learned. And so I started washing coffee cups, and people would come put their coffee cups down and go, "Hey, what's your name? How you doing?" All of a sudden, I was able to express to you guys that I'm having trouble meeting people. I'm having trouble feeling a part of. That was a huge mistake, because all of a sudden I'm a greeter at the Lion's Den, the biggest meeting in Santa Maria. I remember he walked me up like I was a 5-year-old, and Jessica was the secretary, and he said, "I have a greeter for you." She's all, "We already have 2 greeters." And he said, "Well, now you have 3. And it was wonderful. That one thing of pulling me into the herd, all of a sudden I had commitments coming out the yin yang. That's what I needed. All of a sudden I was part of the herd. I started having a personality. I started becoming a part of. So that was about the fourth month. Fifth and sixth month, I decided what I'm hearing, I'm going to start practicing in my life. What a novel idea. I'm going to actually start practicing in my daily life. And I started slowly, but I was like, whoa. You could feel the... When people say weight off your shoulders, I could actually feel it come off my shoulders. Life started becoming more animated. It started becoming more wonderful. I started seeing the beauty of being alive. And I started stop enduring life with my checklist and simply enduring it and getting through that. And I started tossing the checklist aside and started realizing that life is as precious as it is, and that I can get a lot out of it if I start living the life that you guys were explaining and then what the big book was saying. And so the next thing I said, because I thought I could do this program just by the fellowship. I just wanted to be part of the fellowship and listen to the shares. But I realized that if I really wanted everything out of this program, I had to do the steps. I had chosen my first sponsor because I really liked the dude. And he told me what a bad sponsor he was, but he would still sponsor me. And he was right. He's a wonderful person, but he was a sponsor in name only. And so I said, I got to change sponsors, which was hard for me because my number one character defect, and I didn't even see it as a character defect, is people pleasing. I had built this whole life on people pleasing, letting you guys tell me what to do. And so I changed sponsors. I went through the steps, and, on the ninth month, I was driving down Broadway, and I can't explain it, but I heard people talk about it. But I was driving down Broadway, there's a song on the radio, there's everything going on in Santa Maria. It's not a beautiful place. It's no clouds opening. But if you know those old Viewmasters, I'll age myself, but the Viewmaster, you click the little pictures. It's like my whole life just went click. And I kind of looked around, and I went, what? And the same song was on the radio. Everything was the same around. But I knew right then and there, for some reason, something had clicked, and I knew I was going to be okay. I knew everything was going to be okay. I called my buddy Matt, and I said, "Something just happened, Matt. I don't know what it was. I'm not going to call it a spiritual awakening because I don't believe that I'm awake yet. I was so darn asleep that how do I know I'm awake now if I didn't know I was asleep then?" So, but it all changed. Everything, I knew I was going to be okay. I knew this was a solution if I continued the work. The problem is, and the one realization I have to come after that, is that I can go back there in a heartbeat. If I stop doing the work, if I pull away from the program, if I think I'm okay again, because that's my problem. I thought step one and step two were just like my checkbook. I thought, oh, yeah, of course. Oh, yeah, of course. Check them off. I didn't see the importance in those two steps. Step one will take me out above any other step, because once I get everything back, once I'm feeling good about myself, once everything is okay, then I'm not an alcoholic again, and I'll be right back into that thing. So I am so excited that you guys have opened my eyes up to the mystery and the wonder of life and how exciting it is and the spiritual side of life. I had a definite spiritual malady, and that is what I could not feel, and that's why I thought there was no hope. Once I was able to get through the steps, clean house a little bit, because I had this room where I put all my junk and I shut it and I closed it. Step four, maybe go in that room and start pulling things out. And once I started dealing with things and clearing things out, I realized there was a window on the other side of that room and it had light shining through it. And I kept on pulling it. I kept on pulling things out of that room and working as hard as I could and being as honest as I could and truthful as I could. And all of a sudden I was able to look out that window. And that window sheds a beautiful light and it changes everything. But if I start not practicing this, that room gets filled up again and that window gets covered again. I hope I never, ever, ever cover that window up again. I can't, because I cannot believe I discovered it. And it's all because of this program. It's an absolutely beautiful program. And I absolutely love it. And I thank you for having me speak. So.
Thank you so much for coming. Yep.